Welcome everyone to week six of the resilience series. First of all, before we start, I want to just dedicate today's shiur to Nissim Chai Ben Julet. Dedicating the shiur today for his refuah shlema. He should have a speedy recovery. Also, a couple of housekeeping announcements. First of all, we have one more besides today, we have one more week in the series. So today and next week is the end of this series of resilience, which next week we'll also do here. It'll be the last one we have here. In 2 weeks' time is Purim. It's also on a Thursday, the 24th of March. We will be having a session as we always do in Purim's on a Thursday, but that will be the first time we're back there. So a Purim special, a Purim gift. We'll be back in the new place. We'll do a shiur on Purim. We've called it... actually linked to the resilience course, but more directed into a Purim theme. It's called Discovering the Hidden Good in Our Daily Lives, with a special Purim morning tea, as we always do. So that's in 2 weeks' time. So one more week for this series, and then the Purim. After Purim, after the 24th of March, we'll be having a very short series of 2 weeks before the end of the term. And it's the 31st of March and the 7th of April. And I've called that series Four Survivors, which means overcoming the four blockages to inner freedom. It's just a two-week series, which we'll be doing after the 24th of March. So that's the program for the next 2 weeks. Okay. Well, just as we always do, just begin with a bit of a review. Last week, we focused on the concept of finding meaning. We know that while challenge is difficult and often hard to handle, but what we try and do is fill the need, the basic human need, which we explained last week, everyone has at the very core of their existence, the core of their soul, to pursue meaning. And as Viktor Frankl said, as we explained in depth last week, when there's a why, which means when there's a meaning, there can be almost any how. And we talked about channeling our efforts. In other words, when we experience pain, when we experience suffering, when we experience challenge, while the challenge doesn't necessarily go away and nor does the pain, but we try and channel our efforts into something meaningful by looking forward and looking into the future. As we explained last week, the fascinating concept that Rabbi Sacks says, when God reveals himself to Moses at the burning bush and he asks his name, he says, "My name is Eyeh Asher Eyeh," which correctly translated is, "I will be who I will be." In other words, the Jewish survival, the Jewish secret is looking forward, like Rabbi Akiva did at the time of the destruction, as we explained in great detail last week. What I want to do today is, before we put it all together next week, I want to just add in a few more components, a few more points that I think are important when we're talking about resilience. And if there's time towards the end, I want to start talking about and connect it to, and probably finish next week when we put it all together, the concept of happiness in general. So the first thing I want to do is just, I want to make a comment on some of the stories which we've been talking about. You know, there's stories of people where we talk about the heroes of resilience. I told you the story of a book that I've been using, one of the books I've been using, the book by Sherry Mandel, who lost her 14-year-old son to Arab terrorists. And she started a whole movement to help people, and she went through a very long journey, but channeled all her pain into real meaningful stuff. I mentioned last week and the first week that Rebbetzin that spoke, who lost a baby, but then channeled her motherhood instincts into teaching and became a fascinating teacher, educating hundreds and thousands of students. We talked about King David in biblical times being the hero of resilience. We talked about Rabbi Akiva. In Talmudic times, being also the hero of resilience. I told you a little anecdote of the old man in the nursing home who said everything depends on how he looks at it, and the furniture was arranged in his head more than in the room, and it was fascinating even before he saw it, and so on and so forth. I want to share with you one more story, which I actually did mention a few years ago, but I'm going to share it with you again, and then I want to make a comment on understanding some of these stories about these heroes and these great people who are such inspiration of the concept of positivity, gratitude, and resilience. It's a story which was told by Yocheved Rigler in a book which we mentioned a bit a number of years ago called The God Winked. Some of you might remember. And in her book, she tells a story of someone that she met whose name is Dr. Rachamim Melamed Cohen, who at the age of 57 had everything going for him. He was athletic, he was happily married, he was father of six children, he was successful in a career, PhD in special education, a religious observant Jew, and just had everything going for him. And then one day he felt a weakness in his left shoulder, and soon that weakness spread, and unfortunately he was diagnosed with what they call overseas ALS. I think over here they call it motor neuron disease, right? And of course the doctors often do, they spelt out for him the course of what was to come, how he'd become paralyzed and how things would go from bad to worse and so on and so forth. And they ended off by telling him that you have 5 years to live. At the time when Yocheva Rigler wrote this and she had met him, it was 18 years later. Where at that time, by the time the story was written, he was completely paralyzed. And he had been paralyzed already for 7 years. And when he became paralyzed, eventually he actually had to communicate, as they do now, and have this fantastic technology via computer. Computers which are now operated with winks of the eye and blinks of the eye and all kinds of amazing things, which they actually are able, people who can't even use their hands or even can't talk, are able to communicate in an amazing way. She writes that for him it was also a journey. It wasn't all rosy, it wasn't all positive. There was a struggle, there was a journey. At one point in the whole journey, his breathing became heavy. And at one stage, he fainted from a breathing problem, and his wife called the ambulance, the medics arrived, and they went to hospital. And they had to resuscitate him, which she instructed to do. And when he came to, there was obviously this famous, you know, painful question. He was not even sure himself why he was resuscitated, and maybe he shouldn't have been, and maybe there shouldn't have been a respirator, and so on and so forth. But yet then, later on, he said that he's happy he did, because he realized then that the best years of his life were still ahead. So when she writes the story, he was 74, and she describes his daily schedule. He prayed every day in the morning. He had a friend that came to put on tefillin with him. He wrote books through his illness. He wrote many, many books. Communicated, answered emails, had visitors in the afternoon, and had a very, very full life. The reason why I'm mentioning all this is because the end of the whole description of this, she talks about a debate that he had. Now, there was a guy called Dr. Noam Reches, who was the chairman of Israel Medical Ethics Committee and a leading proponent of euthanasia, who had himself many times pulled the plug when people wanted them to, and he debated Dr. Rachamim. And he said, you know, you can't feed yourself. You can't hug the people you love. If I was in your position, I'd want out. To which he responded, these are the most beautiful and happiest years of my life. So then he continues, Dr. Reches, to debate him. And he said, you know, some other ALS patients who were fully conscious and would have asked to end their lives because they didn't want to reach the situation that you're in, where you're completely dependent on other people, right? Dependence is always a big thing. Obviously, everyone wants to be dependent, and that's legitimate. People do want to be dependent, and independent, I should say, and dependence is not something always people want to have. But the end is, when he says this to him, Dr. Rachamim gazes at him, and then he says to him, via the computer, I guess, he says, believe me, my life is no less interesting than yours. In other words, yes, it's true, I might be dependent, I might be in a position which other people could call undignified, or other people would say that there's lack and loss of quality of life. But he didn't see it that way. He saw such positivity, and because he saw such positivity, he was able to accomplish so much. Yes, thank God, with the advance of technology and so on and so forth, but he was able that he really felt loved by all those people that were helping him. People who helped him felt the love that they could give him by helping him, which is another discussion. And he felt that his life was as rich as anyone else's. And he said to that guy, that was his closing line, he said, my life is no less interesting than yours. An amazing ability to take an incredibly negative situation and completely turn it around. Another sort of hero of resilience. Now, why do I mention this? Because I wanted to make a point before we continue. That often when we hear stories like this, and this is not only true about resilience, it's true about every area of personal growth. But we hear about heroes, we hear about Rabbi Akiva, King David, we hear about people in our generation, we hear about people like Dr. Rachamim. people like Sherry Mandel. These are great people, and they've risen to great heights and achieved an amazing mindsets. But the danger of some of these stories, I think it's important to understand them properly. The danger is that they can be taken two ways. Sometimes they can serve as tremendous inspiration, which I'm hoping that when we tell the stories, that's what, the way it's taken. But they do have a danger of having the opposite effect. And this is true in all areas of growth where we hear about great people and stories of great people. You know, in Jewish experience, there's a tremendous emphasis on telling stories. You know, there's even a custom that at the end of Shabbat, when you have what's called the Malava Malka, which is the final meal of Shabbat, not the third meal in the afternoon, but the meal after Shabbat comes out, there's a tradition to sit down and have a meal, sing songs to sort of farewell the Shabbat. There's a famous custom to tell a story of a tzaddik, to tell a story of a great man, great woman at the time of Malava Malka, right? And generally, there's a concept, there's many, many volumes of books that are written about what we call Sipurei Tzaddikim, stories of the righteous. The Talmud, even though the Talmud is a body of Jewish law, but it's filled with stories. And sometimes the problem with these stories are that we look and saying, yeah, that's a great story, but it's nothing to do with me. I'm not a hero. I'm just a regular person. I've got my natural personality. I've got my challenges. My challenges are felt. I feel them strongly. It's all very good to tell me a story about Reb Zusha or the Rabbi Akiva or this one or that one. They're on a different level, and that's very nice. I enjoyed the story. It was very entertaining and stimulating and made for a very beautiful Malava Malka meal at the end of Shabbat. But I don't know if I can really take it to heart because it's not me. I will never and cannot ever reach that level. Right? And I've heard that from people before, and people feel that. So the question is, what is the purpose of these stories? And I wanted to mention it because the purpose of these stories are very, very important, and I'll tell you why. Number one, there's the concept, we've always talked about this many, many times. Every day when we say the Shema, there's the famous sentence which I've mentioned many, many times of where God says, "V'ahavta at Hashem elokecha," you should love God, your God, "b'chol levavcha," with all your heart, "b'chol nafshecha," with all your soul, or "b'chol me'odecha." And the translation of me'odecha is a problematic word. The commentaries battle to understand what does it actually mean. Nafshecha means your soul, we've got a heart, you've got to love God with your heart. Nafshecha, your soul, you've got to put your whole passion, your whole inside, your whole being into it. What does it mean, b'chol me'odecha? So, one translation is with all your might. Another translation is with all your resources, like money, financial resources, other resources, you've got to just give everything of, you know, towards the goal, towards the mission. But there's another very, very deep and fundamental translation that goes like this. The word in Hebrew for me'od, the word me'od in Hebrew means very. Tov me'od means very good. If you conjugate that word, which isn't normally conjugated, but if you conjugate that word, me'odecha means your very. Me'od shalcha, your very. What does that mean? The definition of very means to do more than you can. Very means to challenge yourself, to go beyond your comfort zone, to take one step forward. And the fundamental critical concept in Judaism is that God doesn't want us to reach someone else's very. He wants us to reach our very. Meaning, He wants us to push ourselves. He wants us to grow beyond ourselves. He wants us to connect to something larger than ourselves. But as long as we're pushing our comfort zone, as long as we're going beyond our comfort zone, our levels of spiritual fitness, as I always call it, or as long as we're going beyond what we're used to now and what we're comfortable with now, that's what God wants. Now, in a month from now, that might shift because we might get comfortable where we are now and then need to push it again. But that's the point. The point is not to reach the level of Rabbi Akiva. The point is not to reach the level of King David or the great hero. The point is to do the little bit that we can. The little bit that we can do, if we find ourselves in a bit of a hole, if we find ourselves in a challenge, we find ourselves in a challenging situation, to push ourselves and to say, I've got to be more positive and I've got to move on, I've got to bounce back. I might not be perfect. I might still have really, really negative experiences. I might have negative thoughts. I might still feel very low. I might go up and down. There might be a seesaw, a roller coaster. But I've got to push myself a little bit in my level. So the question is, if it's me'odecha, if it's my very, then what's the point of the story? So I want to share with you a beautiful concept that I once heard from a mentor of mine in yeshiva. And this was said in a different context, but the concept still exists. The concept is like this. They used to talk about a lot, particularly before Rosh Hashanah, the idea of stock taking, you know, personal reflection. We know that it's important, every person should never be obsessed with this, but it's important that every once in a while we sort of are honest with ourselves, that we reflect, we take stock, and we analyze ourselves to see where we're up to, what we could be doing, what are our strengths, what are our weaknesses, what we can be improving on, how we can grow, and so on and so forth. In Hebrew, it's called a cheshbon hanefesh, a reckoning of the soul. So I was taught the following, that when you do a cheshbon hanefesh, when you do this reflection, the self-reflection and self-stock-taking, you need to think of three, you have to ask three questions. And let's understand the importance of these three questions. The three questions are, how, number one, how should it be? Second is, how can it be? And the third is, how it is. What does that mean? The first question we have to think about is, what's the ultimate goal? So if we talk about resilience, what does resilience look like in the ideal? What does a resilient person look like in perfection? So the answer to that question is stories like Rabbi Akiva, King David, Dr. Rachamim, and so on and so forth. All the stories, the heroes of resilience. But then the second question we have to ask ourselves is, well, that's how it should be, but how could it be? Because let's be honest, I'm not going to reach that level. I'm not going to reach Rabbi Akiva's level. I'm not going to reach that hero's level. So I need to think about, well, how could it be for me? In other words, how can I improve? How can I push my comfort zone? That's the second question. How, not how should it be, but how could it be? And of course, that comes on the back of the question, if I'm honest, of how it is. So in other words, I need to think of how am I now? Where am I up to now? What am I doing now? This is true for all areas of growth, by the way. Right? How am I faring now, this present moment? How could I improve my very? In other words, how can I push my comfort zone a little bit? But I also have to ask the question of how should it be? What's the ideal, even though I can never reach it? And he asked the question and he said, what's the point of that question? In other words, isn't the two questions enough? Shouldn't I just be able to say, how is it and how can it be? In other words, let me just see where I am and let me see what I can do. What's the point of the question of how should it be? And he said something very, very profound. He said, because when you think how should it be, the how could it be becomes different. In other words, there's how I am now, there's how I think I can be to improve, but I'm not benchmarking it against anything. When I ask myself the third question of how should it be, I lift the bar even on how could it be. Am I clear? Yeah. In other words, the how could it be, how is it, is just an honest reflection, an honest assessment, it's being honest with ourselves. How should it be is what we get taught. The how could it be depends on how should it be. When I know how should it be, then I push myself a little bit more. And I was just thinking about it as I was telling you these stories over the last few weeks of amazing resilience experiences. Maybe some of them we're not able to reach, maybe the average guy. Maybe these are very special individuals, could be. But when we are inspired by these very special individuals, whether they're biblical or Talmudical or contemporary, when we see what resilience looks like in its ultimate state, then when we push ourselves and are inspired to take the next steps towards the journey of resilience, we're able to push it a little bit further. We're able to know what we're aspiring to because we know what the goalposts are. And therefore, yes, we know we're not able or nor supposed to reach the final goal, but we want to inch a little bit closer than maybe we would have otherwise. So therefore, when we ask ourselves the question of how should it be, then the how can it be or could it be becomes a little bit different, becomes better. And that's the purpose of the stories. And I think it's an important thing to bear in mind. The purpose of the stories are never to make anyone despondent. Like, oh, okay, well, if that's what it means, then I can never get there. Purpose of learning about these things are to know what I'm working towards, but then to understand that God wants my very. He doesn't want anyone else's very. He wants my very, but my very with a bit of a push, bearing in mind the ultimate. So when we're talking about resilience, I wanted to now talk about two things, two other components that are very, very important to address in the journey of resilience. We've talked about persistence, we've talked about finding meaning, we've talked about the ability to have a positive mindset, to notice things that are not obviously good or the hidden good in the less obvious and so on and so forth. But I wanted to talk about two other components which we've talked about in previous series, but they're very important to bring back into the discussion on resilience because if we don't address them, they will affect the journey of resilience. And the first one is guilt, a Jewish topic. One of the greatest barriers to resilience is often guilt. Why? Because often what happens is, particularly when the challenge comes from something that happened to someone else, whether it be tragedy or a loss, the human nature is often, because we're so devastated, is to start blaming ourselves. Now, in Sherry Mandel's book, she has a brilliant chapter on this. And she says that the instinctive response is that a mother who loses a child, for example, is bad. She says, she writes down her initial feelings. I'm a guilty mother. I'm a bad mother. One that has lost all that she was supposed to protect and cherish. Right? When you have a responsibility and something happens that you're not able to perform that responsibility, we often blame ourselves and we become ridden with guilt. You know, in her case, in hindsight, you start to say, you know, if only I would have done that. For example, she talks about moving to where she moved, where that cave was that her son was ultimately killed. It's in a place called Tekoa. She says, why did I move to Tekoa? There was a possibility to take an apartment with someone else. Why did I end up moving? I wouldn't have moved there. It wouldn't have happened, right? Why didn't I have a proper conversation with them the night before with my son? She says, her son, she describes her son in a very interesting way. He's like a regular 14-year-old kid, a little bit mischievous. In fact, the tragedy became because of a bit of mischief. He and a friend decided they were going to take off school. They go late to school and they go exploring a cave a little bit, just to have some fun. And the night before, he was like talking to her and she was busy, so she couldn't talk to him. So she blamed, maybe if he would have talked to me, maybe he would have told me his plans. Maybe I could have stopped it. You know, the 1,000,000,000 questions we start to ask ourselves, and often that is what stands in the way of bouncing back. In these types of challenging, all different types of challenge, but in these types of challenging situations, particularly when the challenge comes from some loss or tragedy, that becomes the question. If only I would have taken care of that person better. If only I would have gone to that doctor. If only I would have listened to that opinion. And so on, and it goes on and on and on. But we know that's fundamentally opposed to critical Jewish thinking. Because we know that there are two concepts when it comes to guilt, and we need to understand them. Two concepts when it comes to guilt is as follows. First of all, as we've mentioned many times, guilt is not necessarily a bad thing. Guilt was created for a reason. The reason that guilt was created is because guilt is actually essential for growth, generally. Because the purpose of guilt normally is that when we feel bad about something, we learn from it and we move on. In other words, if I don't feel uncomfortable with where I am now, I will not improve tomorrow. Right? We know that in the process of the new year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we mentioned this a number of times, where the Rambam Maimonides talks about the concept of tshuva, repentance, return, reconnection, improvement for the next year. He gives like 4 or 5 stages that are necessary for that process. And the stage one is cheshbon, you have to reflect on the past, and stage two is charata. You have to regret. You have to feel bad about what you've done. So a certain level of discomfort for things that we've done is essential to grow as a human being. But there are two things we have to bear in mind. So guilt can be a very, very positive thing if it's managed properly. Because the first thing we need to bear in mind, as we've said so many times, is we always have to ask ourselves the question of who is controlling what? Am I controlling the guilt or is the guilt controlling me? When I manage my guilt, when I feel bad, but I'm able to manage the emotion and control the emotion, and I'm able to say, okay, I feel bad enough to learn from my mistakes, to resolve for the future, to make resolutions going forward, but then that's it. I'm done with the guilt. Guilt has now served its purpose. It's overstayed its welcome, and it's now welcome to leave. Then guilt is a good thing. Guilt often doesn't work like that. What happens with guilt, negative guilt, is we let the guilt control us. It obsesses us. We walk around the whole day with guilt and it draws us down. And in fact, what often happens with guilt that controls us is that instead of the guilt being a catalyst for growth, it actually is a catalyst for paralysis, spiritual paralysis. We're actually not able to move. We're not able to do anything. We're not able to improve. We're not able to take the next step. It has exactly the opposite effect. It becomes one of the most destructive emotions. I know this is a very big challenge because us Jews are experts at guilt, blaming and thinking, and especially Jewish mothers, without sounding right. Because we have a deep sense of responsibility, and therefore we always blame ourselves. We always put ourselves. We always blame something, whatever the case is, right? So that's the first thing. First thing we need to know about guilt is that we need to control the guilt. Guilt has its place, as long as we control it. And then we say goodbye to it. It's like a guest that's got to go after a while, when it gets too comfortable. The second, of course, is something we've talked about so many times, but it's so fundamental to Jewish thinking. And that's the concept of Hashgacha Pratit. Hashgacha Pratit is the belief that things happen because they meant to happen. No matter how painful they are, no matter how much we don't understand, no matter even if we can learn going forward, this is a difficult thing to understand. If someone breaks into my house, I need to believe that it was meant to happen. That is not a contradiction to saying, you know, I think it would be good to fix my security. Right? Often people battle with this. Because it was meant to happen, well then let me leave the door open next tomorrow night and maybe it's meant to happen too, you know. No, because that's not moral living. Moral living means responsible living. God wants us to control our responsible living. In other words, He wants us to live responsibly. Part of living, as we've often said, everything's in the hands of heaven besides besides fear of heaven, which means my moral choices I'm responsible for. It's a moral obligation to learn from my mistakes and to put in place good choices for the future. But how those good choices pan out has nothing to do with what happens ultimately. Because ultimately, if God wants something to happen, it's going to happen. So therefore, yes, it could be that if I had better locks, someone wouldn't have broken into my house last night. But if it already happened, fundamental to Jewish faith is the concept of if someone stole something in my house, ultimately it was meant to happen. It's painful. It could have been something very, very valuable, but it was meant to happen. It, at the same time, God wants me to look at the situation and say, what can you learn from this? And if it means better security or if it means better precautions, then that's what it means. And I've got to put that in place for future, and God will respond the way He wants to respond. That's my choice. I'm mentioning someone breaking in because that's a fairly simple example, but it's true with everything. Ultimately, if someone suffers even the greatest tragedy, which we don't understand, and we mentioned this so many times, and understanding is not what we're supposed to be doing, and we have questions, and the questions can be legitimate, but part of the concept of emunah, and emunah is not an easy thing, emunah normally translated as faith, but the truth is emunah has another translation. The translation of emunah is to trust, right? Ish emunah means a trustworthy person, imun, to trust, trustworthiness. The concept of so critical to Jewishness is emunah, which we normally say belief or faith, but it also means trust. Trust means it's a certain level of surrendering which people don't like to do. It's a certain level of understanding we're in God's hands. And if we're in God's hands, that means that He does things, whatever happens to me outside of me is from Him, even unfortunately the most painful things. Why He does it, what's the plan, what's the bigger picture, who knows? We don't understand, as we've said so many times, we don't need to understand, we're not supposed to understand, we're not supposed to rationalize, we're not supposed to justify, but yet we can find within ourselves, after all of that, to say, I understand that it was from You. Why, I don't know, but I accept it. Accepting doesn't mean I understand it. Accepting means I trust that You know what You're doing, but beyond me, and that's okay. At a funeral, God forbid, we recite something called Siddur Kadin. It's the craziest thing. People can be at the most sad times of their, the most saddest times of their life, and there's certain things that happen which are unbelievable. I don't know if you ever followed the meaning of these things. We have something called Siddur Kadin, and we have something called Kaddish. Everyone knows about Kaddish. Kaddish is something we say whenever someone is lost, right? People don't often know that Kaddish has nothing to do with a person dying. There's nothing in there about a person passing away. It's everything in there about emunah, about believing in God. The first verse of Kaddish is Yitkadal v'yitkadash shmer abba. We may be glorified and made great the name of God. That's what a Jew is able to do in a time of grief, in a time of pain, where it's challenged and it's difficult and it's hard, and yet Siddur Kadin means we accept Your judgment. It's from God. We don't know why, but Yitkadal v'yitkadash. That's what emunah means. But one of the things that comes out of emunah is actually a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to accept. But if we reach it and we connect to the concept of emunah, we get rid of the guilt. Because although we learn whatever we have to learn, but we accept that it actually wasn't me. Now, accepting it wasn't me and accepting it was from God raises other questions. How could a God do this? Right? These are theological questions, age-old questions. We're not alone. Moses had these questions many times. Moses himself, the greatest person of Emunah, the greatest believer. In fact, the Zohar calls Moses the one who fed us belief. He was the one who guided us in belief. And he had questions. He had questions before the Jews were taken out of Egypt. Why did God make it worse after he was sent? He had questions, the Talmud says, when he was shown a vision of future generations and he saw the demise of Rabbi Akiva. He saw how Rabbi Akiva would ultimately be tortured and put to death by the Romans. And he said to God, what? Rabbi Akiva? Zu Torah v'zu schara? Is this Torah? Is this reward? And God says, silence. No answer. And Moses understood. No answer means there are certain things that are beyond our brain, certain, beyond our intellect. But it also, it's a hard thing. Moses found it difficult. We find it difficult. We work on it. It's a lifelong process. You've got to work on Emunah. It doesn't come naturally, meaning it is there naturally. We believe that it's at the very core of every Jewish soul. But we've got to work hard to bring it out, to ignite it, to feel it, to be conscious of it. But the greatness of Emunah is that it takes away the guilt. It actually paves the way for resilience. It paves the way to bounce back, because then we know accepting that it's God means we're in the hand of God. We let God guide us and we take away the guilt. We might have made mistakes for which we learn, but we don't give ourselves ridden with guilt and we're able then to move on. Someone wrote to me a beautiful thing. I'll read it to you. A pencil maker, was an aunt of mine in New York. She sends me these things once in a while, so I just noticed it the other day. She says, a pencil maker told the pencil 5 important lessons just before putting it in the box. Number one, he said to the pencil, everything you do will always leave a mark. Right, so that's important responsibility. We know whatever we do, we don't make just it's not random. We need to think before we act, before we speak, before we do things, because whatever we do leaves a mark. On the other hand, he said, number two, you can always correct the mistakes you make. Number three, what is important is what is inside of you. Right? It's not the casing, it's what's inside of you. It's important, and we've often talked about the concept of working inside out rather than outside in. Number four, he said, the harsh reality is in life you will undergo painful sharpenings, but they will only make you better. And then number five, he says, to be the best pencil, you must allow yourself to be held and guided by the hand that holds you. And that's Emunah. Is that? And that's Emunah. In other words, Emunah is not surrender to the point that we don't think for ourselves, that we don't act for ourselves, that we don't make choices. On the contrary, the first lesson is as important as the last lesson. God gave us tremendous responsibility. He gave us tremendous choices in terms of our moral living and choosing between right and wrong. We have a huge contribution to make. We are wanted by God. We are necessary. Every individual is necessary. Otherwise, we wouldn't be born. If we just, we're not an accident. There's a mission to life. There's a meaning to life on the one hand. Secondly, we can correct the mistakes we make and we can learn from those mistakes. And sharpenings are painful, but they do make us better. But it all works on the foundation of Emunah. We need to let ourselves be held and guided by the hand that holds us, even though we don't understand sometimes how he's drawing us or how he's turning us. But if we allow ourselves, we give up that control. That's so hard, but necessary and liberating. When we give up that control and we allow ourselves, as he said, it's beautiful to be held and guided by the hand that holds us, that takes away things like guilt. It makes it easier to accept, and it contributes to the experience of resilience, because then we're able to take away the guilt, understand that it's for a higher purpose, understand that there's something going on that we don't understand, and to move on. So that's, I wanted to address that today, the guilt aspect of resilience, very important to deal with often, because otherwise it stands in the way of resilience. The second thing is the concept of forgiveness. Now, this is a very, very important one. And this is more when resilience is needed, or when we talk about resilience, not so much in the face of tragedy, but more in the face of challenges that have to do more with human relationships. Right? Where we also need resilience just as much as we need it in the face of challenge. Because often the lack of forgiveness, or not being able to forgive, also stands in the way of resilience. When we get very, very bogged down by you know, blaming or hating or feelings of revenge, and those feelings don't seem to go away, they cannot be bouncing back. People who are filled with anger, people who are filled with revenge, and they always have it against the other person, even when it's legitimate, ultimately resilience becomes an impossibility because it gets us stuck. Those feelings are feelings of trapping us. They trap us. Resentment, revenge, hate is all trapping type of emotions. Now, we once did a whole series on forgiveness, some of you would remember. Just to highlight some of the points again, put it into the process of forgiveness. What is forgiveness, first of all? What does forgiveness mean? And I think just to highlight and to review the point of forgiveness very quickly is this. Number one, as we've said many times, that forgiveness is not only for the benefit of the person who is forgiven. It's good to be forgiven if you hurt somewhere else, but forgiveness is essential for the person who is forgiving. As I told you a number of times about the prayer that he said before people go to sleep. I think it's from the Arizal, or it's one of the great sages who sorry, I can't close the door because there is no door there. They're actually fixing the door. So it's an open door. It's one of those things, you know. Could do lots of things, but not that. So there's a prayer that said before a person goes to sleep that says, Master of the universe, I hereby forgive all those that have hurt me and insulted me and offended me and damaged me and so on and so forth. And it's all a prayer of forgiveness, which of course all the people of who you are forgiving know nothing about this because you're in your bedroom about to go to sleep. So what's the purpose? But the purpose is that forgiveness is not about the person I'm forgiving only. In fact, it's more important for me who's doing the forgiving, right? So forgiveness is critical. Why is forgiveness critical? Because what is the definition of forgiveness? First of all, important to point out, as we've done many times, but if we're talking about getting rid of resentment, forgiveness does not mean agreeing with what has been done. That's the problem with forgiveness. In other words, that's why people find it so difficult, because people think forgiveness is a weakness where I give in and I condone what has been done to me. Now, there might be ways of condoning it, or there might be ways of judging favorably, but sometimes not. Sometimes someone hurts me that's just plain wrong. Or someone says to me something that was plainly hurtful and plainly offensive and was just wrong. Right? I mean, I can judge them favorably. I can say, look, if maybe they're stressed out, they've lost their living, I don't know, whatever, but it could be still not wrong. It's plainly wrong, right? There is wrong and right sometimes. I mean, a lot of gray areas in right, and sometimes it's a matter of perspective. True. But sometimes it's not. Sometimes just plainly wrong. People do wrong things. But forgiveness doesn't mean agreeing with what was done. All forgiveness means is getting rid of the feeling of resentment. Sounds easy, but it's very difficult. There's nothing more destructive and damaging than for a person to walk around with a feeling of resentment, a feeling of hate. It destroys the human being. It makes the person stuck. It makes us unhappy. Happiness brings growth. Unhappiness, resentment, holds us back. That's the way it works. Now, you might remember that we once talked about a whole concept of forgiveness, and we said that actually the commentaries and the sources tell us there's actually three types of forgiveness, because not always we're able to forgive at the highest level. And just to briefly review it, the three levels of forgiveness are this. One level of forgiveness is that if a person has done something really bad to me, I at least are able to get to the level where I don't wish bad upon the other person. In other words, at least I might not get rid of the resentment, but I get rid of the revenge. And I say, I hope that person is successful. I don't want anything bad to happen to that person. Now, you might think it's a simple thing to do. It's actually not. Because, you know, I've said this before, you know sometimes how someone you really can't stand or someone did something terrible to you or to someone, and then suddenly something happens to them and you don't show that you're happy, but you give a little smile and you say, you know. You know, what goes around comes around, you know, kind of thing. It's interesting, you know. We'll see how that person handles it now, all that kind of stuff, right? So that's human nature. So even the first level is not that simple. To really, in your heart, not want any bad for the person who has done you bad is already progress. The second level is to go a step further and not to hate. To actually have no feelings of resentment. To let go. Let go of resentment. Very hard, but very powerful. And the third is, which is number one, a very high level, and number two, not always possible, and that is to actually restore the relationship as if nothing ever happened. In other words, to restore the relationship completely to what it was before. And that's always not. But the goal of forgiveness is really to get to level two. If we're not able to do it, the least we can get to is level one. Level three is hard. To if someone has really hurt you badly and seriously hurt you, not always it's possible, not even always it's advisable necessarily to engage in the relationship and to restore the relationship to what it was. That's true. And some relationships are toxic, and some relationships just need to end. And some relationships are just healthy for both people not to engage. That's also true. But what we can do, we can do what's in our power. And what's in our power is to let go of resentment, to let go of hate. To come to the conclusion about, to fill our minds with positive things. To fill our minds with the thought and the notion that we mentioned a couple of weeks ago about usefulness. Like, what actually am I benefiting from holding on to the hate? The person who hurt me has long forgotten about it. They've truly forgotten about it. It's not even bothering them anymore anyway. Right? And I'm still walking around with it 2 years later, 3 years later. I'm not talking to the person. I can't even remember why. But I know I'm just not talking to that person. I know I don't like the person. I don't know. I'm not sure why. Right? Often, I mean, it sounds funny, but that's what, you know? It's like that, you know that famous Jewish joke about the person's on an island, he's two shuls, one he davens in, the one he doesn't go to. We also, with people also, you know, the people I talk to, the people I don't talk to. I'm not quite sure why, but I just don't talk to them, right? That's because I have that hate. Because people do that. They walk around with hate, upsetness. It's this feeling of, often it's a feeling of, a misguided feeling of justice. Like, if I don't hate that person, then I'm giving in. The person couldn't care less, because they don't even know what you're feeling. But I'm not going to stop hating that person because that person's bad. That person, you're not punishing a person at all. You're punishing yourself. Right? But it's not simple to let go of hate. It's hard. But it takes the whole process. And of course, now's not the time to go into it. We've done this before about all the steps that are needed to actually achieve that. But we need to work on that. And part of it also, again, is going back to the emunah. That at the end of the day, if something happened to me, no matter if it was a tree that fell on my head, God forbid, or was someone that did something bad to me, at the end of the day, what happens to me is for a reason, and I can make it be an ingredient for greater growth. I can make it make me a stronger person. Forget about whether it was that person's fault or not that person's fault, whether it was his or her choice or not their choice, if they should be punished or not. It's not my business. My business is it happened to me. I'm in God's hands. Let me try and use it. Let me try and use it for something positive. One of the ways we do that, by the way, is to learn the art, and this is important because when we get rid of something, we need to know what we are supposed to do. And I've mentioned this thought before, but it's such an important thought. It's the concept of substitution. I mentioned it the other night as well in the gratitude share. Because, I'll just mention this, it's coming up to Pesach soon. Not that I want to scare anyone, but it is coming up to Pesach soon. It's 2 weeks to Purim, which means 6 weeks to Pesach. So, in Pesach, we have the four cups of wine that we drink. And the four cups of wine that we drink on the Seder night is to remember the four expressions of redemption that God used when He took us out of Egypt. When God told Moses to take the Jewish people out of Egypt, He used four expressions of redemption. I will take you out, I will save you, I will redeem you, and I will make you my nation. Right? Now there's a very strange halakha, a very strange law. And that is that if someone, we're supposed to drink four cups of wine on Pesach now, that's the law, that's the halakha. How about if a person wants to drink extra wine? A little bit crazy, he wants to drink extra one, an extra l'chaim. So the law is like this, that between the first and second cup, you're allowed to. Not encouraged, but you're allowed to if you're desperate. Between the second and third cup is when we eat the meal, gezunt haet, like if you want to say another l'chaim and wish each other well, and you know, if you game for extra wine on that night, that's fine, you can. However, between the third and the fourth cup, you cannot interrupt. The third cup must run into the fourth cup without any interruption with any other wine. It's got to flow. Why is it such a law? So there's many explanations. One of them go like this. If you look at the three expressions of redemption, right, you'll see an interesting thing. The first three are where we're going away from. God says, I will redeem you, I will take you out, I will save you. In other words, I will remove you from the negative. Right? I will take you out of spiritual slavery, of psychological slavery, of emotional slavery. The third one is what I'm going to do, what I'm going to make of you. I'm going to make you my nation. Right? So the rabbis tell us like this. In every part of growth, there's two parts. you let go of something bad, but then you must substitute it right away with something good. Between the third and the fourth cup, you can't stop. Because as soon as you let go a negative thing, you have a vacuum. When you have a vacuum, you become vulnerable. You become vulnerable to something more negative. The human being has to be filled with something. The human being must pursue some meaning. The human being must grow. If you don't engage in something positive and you've left something negative, you've left room for something more negative. You become very vulnerable at that spot. So therefore, the rabbis say, Ben Gimel Adalah, between the third and the fourth cup, don't interrupt, because fill it with something positive. The same thing with forgiveness. It's not enough to forgive someone, which means that definition is to let go of resentment. We've got to fill our lives with positive things. That's what we talked about last week. You can't say, well, I'm going to work on myself. I'm not going to be angry with anyone anymore. I'm going to let go of the anger, let go of the guilt. And what are you going to do? I'm just going to be. A human being can't just be. So when we get rid of negative thoughts, we've got to substitute with positive thoughts. We've got to engage with something positive, like study, like helping someone, like thinking good about someone else, like trying to find the good in other situations. We've got to fill our minds with positivity. But having said that, just going back to the concept of forgiveness, I wanted to bring that in because forgiveness is a very important part of resilience, particularly when the resilience is bouncing back from a situation which is more interpersonal rather than personal grief or tragedy, but it's more about relationships, which we also can be very traumatic, and the trauma there can be equally as traumatic and negative as personal tragedy sometimes, but yet still requires resilience and the journey of resilience. And in that journey of resilience, forgiveness is often a very, very important critical component. Just talking about people that we have to forgive. Where's Mandy? Oh, Mandy once sent me something a long time ago, which was very funny. I'll just read it to you. I was looking through a bunch of different things a couple of days ago, so I came across this. It won't add tremendous meaning to what I just explained, just a cute thing. It says, it was like this. It says, towards the end of Shabbat morning service, Rabbi Joseph asked his congregation, remember this one? How many of you have forgiven your enemies? So 80% of them held up their hands. So the rabbi then repeated the question. This time everyone responded except for an old man called Clive Cohen. So he says, Mr. Cohen, are you not willing to forgive your enemies? Mr. Cohen says, I don't have any enemies. So Mr. Cohen, that's very unusual. How old are you? He says, I'm 98 years old. So the whole congregation starts to stand up and clap their hands. You know, the wonderful guy, he lived his whole life without any enemies. So the rabbi says, okay, Mr. Cohen, would you please come down to the front and tell us how a person can live 98 years and not have an enemy in the world? So he totters down to the front of the shul, gets to the pulpit, turns around, faces the congregation and says very simply, I've outlived all those low lives. However, in the journey of resilience, it's not a good idea to wait till we're 98. So we'll have to choose the path of forgiveness is a much more recommended and encouraged practice. I just want to end off, and let's do this together. It's on your handout, and I've done this with you many years ago, but I thought I'd just share it with you again, because it's just about the whole concept of positivity. So this is a thing which someone once wrote. Let's read it together, and it says, this is the truth. It sounds very negative, by the way. If we turn things upside down, it's much better done on a PowerPoint, which I don't have yet. We can't expect goodness to win in the world. I would be lying to you if I said that the human race has a great future ahead, that altruism could replace egotism, that your lives could be filled with joy, that your children could be safe and healthy. Before anything, you must know the human race does not deserve these things. And I am convinced of this because I know you. Corruption and hypocrisy are in your nature. Compassion breeds weakness when only the strong survive, and I refuse to believe under any circumstances that you can turn things around in the coming years. The world may be sinking into new depths, but there are even more revelations to come. The human race has only one destiny, and whether you like it or not, that is what is real. I am the Lord your God. You should know that I believe the exact opposite if you read it the other way around. Now, if you go up, it reads differently. It says, I am the Lord your God. This is what is real, and whether you like it or not, the human race has only one destiny. There are even more revelations to come. The world may be sinking to new depths, but you can turn things around in the coming years. And I refuse to believe under any circumstances that compassion breeds weakness when only the strong survive. Corruption and hypocrisy are in your nature, and I'm convinced of this because I know you. The human race does not deserve these things. Before anything, you must know that your children can be safe and healthy, that your lives can be filled with joy, that altruism could replace egotism. The human race has a great future ahead. If I'll be lying to you if I said that we can't expect goodness to win in the world, if we turn things upside down, that is the truth. It all depends how we look at things. Because resilience has everything to do, as we've said the last few weeks, resilience does not, this is the important part, resilience does not change the facts. Resilience is not about denial. Resilience is only how we reinterpret the facts. The words are exactly the same. It all depends how we read them. Just before you go, once again, next week, back here for the last time to finish the series. The next week after the 24th of March, we have a special Purim one back in Bina, so please come. It'll be the first time we're back in Bina on a Thursday morning with a morning tea, a Purim special, and after that, a 2 short week series. Have a great week.